This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be taking another look at what's happening with the three lawsuits filed against the National Security Agency.
You're still being electronically surveilled every day and every moment. Your emails are unsafe. Hear why that's still happening and how a Congress and the courts, certainly the Congress, have laid down.
Co-host Dalia Hashad speaks with Amnesty International's Mona Kadena about tasers in the second part of our three-part series. We'll also discuss a recent visit with death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal. We hear an interview and an excerpt from a speech from former Amnesty International director Bill Shultz.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dalia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
A few months ago, it was revealed that the National Security Agency was engaging in warrantless wiretapping against Americans as well as people overseas. Since those revelations, there have been massive, massive publicity about more wiretapping than was first revealed. There's also been a slew of lawsuits filed against the NSA, National Security Agency, some of the telephone providers, and others regarding this warrantless wiretapping. Three of those lawsuits are the most prominent, one by the Center for Constitutional Rights, one by the ACLU, and one by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Today, we're really pleased to have with us as a guest the lead attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights on the NSA lawsuit, Shane Katadil. Shane, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
So, Shane, is the first question, really. I know it's been a few months now. And there's been some developments in these lawsuits. And I guess you want to talk about the three lawsuits, the main ones, but there's been others as well. So why don't you give us a short summary of the three main lawsuits? What have some of the developments been since the filings?
Sure. Well, there's been one major development, which is really that the government is trying to preempt all of the litigation, just cut it off at the knees by asserting what's called the state secrets privilege. And I can talk about that in detail a little bit more. But let me kind of run down the sort of overview of the litigation. The first cases that were filed in January were filed by CCR and then also one by the ACLU on the same date. And those are sort of general challenges, you know, directed at the government defendants trying to put a halt to the NSA program itself.
Now, in the center case, as I recall, you're representing actually center attorneys who are in communication frequently with people the United States government alleges are terrorists. And so our claim really is that the attorneys at the center have been surveilled. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, you know, really our claim is almost independent of whether or not we were actually targets, because it just makes it so difficult for you to do your job as a lawyer when your clients and when witnesses in your cases and when co-counsel are people who are located overseas. You know, remember that in December when the president admitted, you know, owned up to this program, they said initially that it was a narrowly focused program, that it was targeted only at international calls. That is, you know, one party's outside of the U.S. and one party's inside the U.S. So no domestic calls, and then also only targeted at individuals, you know, where basically at conversations where one person on the line had some link to terrorism. And, you know, some of the other cases that have been filed since then have really given the lie to that sort of notion that this is a narrow program, because the next significant case that was filed was by Electronic Frontier Foundation, and their suit was really a private lawsuit. It had, you know, sort of private telephone subscribers of AT&T who were suing only AT&T. They weren't suing the government. And their claim was that there was a little secret room inside the main switching station of AT&T in San Francisco where the NSA had set up a huge number of computers and interception devices, and basically that all the signals going into that main switching station from all of AT&T's lines were being siphoned off. A copy was being sent to the NSA, basically, in this secret room.
Now, this doesn't only include telephone. It includes email as well, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, it's almost indistinguishable when you look at the way the telecom system works. There's almost no distinction between email and internet traffic and phone calls.
Because they all come in these little packets, right?
That's right. Yeah, digital calls move around the same way as email does. So their case is interesting, you know, in a number of respects. One, it shows that that NSA has set up, the infrastructure to intercept basically every single phone call and email. So, you know, not necessarily just international calls, but basically everything. And so that gives us the sense that there is a much wider sort of form of surveillance going on here, that the NSA may be, you know, sort of scanning every single email that's sent by anyone in the U.S. and potentially even using voice recognition or technologies like that to scan every single phone call and try to pick out, you know, a single word spoken in a single language. And then if that, you know, word is present, then maybe have a human listen to that call.
Right. So if you have a word like Guantanamo or a word like, well, your name, Shane, for example.
Of course, my name, yeah.
Or any of the hosts of this program.
That's right. So it's interesting because the first media stories, including the New York Times story that broke all of this NSA surveillance scandal back in December, had indicated, you know, that there was something broader going on, that something, you know, sort of more akin to a data mining program was happening, really something, you know, where the government was trying to scan every single communication without any prior suspicion, you know, no suspicion that somebody on the line was a terrorist, and no real limitation to international calls either. So the EFF case would tend to support that conclusion. They have, you know, documents from an AT&T whistleblower, basically, you know, showing what the equipment sort of setup is like in this AT&T switching station, that the NSA, you know, has a secret room, and that all the fiber optic cables, a copy goes off into this secret room, and from there, I mean, who knows what happens to it.
So we have a situation really now where there's this massive warrantless surveillance outside of the Fourth Amendment, outside of the special court that was set up, some type of surveillance out that was supposedly secret, and we have all these lawsuits. And so you were bringing us up to the next step. The next step that's happened in these lawsuits is what?
Well, you know, we filed the lawsuits. These lawsuits were all filed in January, and the government asked for some extra time to consider how it was going to respond. And then within the last month, they have, you know, in our suit, in the ACLU suit, they've asserted what's called the state secrets privilege. And they've basically said, you know, look, this litigation can't go forward without, you know, posing the risk that secret information that is essential to national security will leak out in some manner. They've also, the government has also intervened. They've tried to, you know, basically move in as a party to the AT&T suit and said, look, this suit against AT&T, you know, nominally a private defendant, can't go forward either because it would tend to reveal, you know, sort of classified information that the government needs to protect national security. The interesting thing about this state secrets privilege is the sort of mechanics of how it works. Basically, you know, according to the government, the legal standard is that an agency head, you know, John Negroponte or the Director of Homeland Security or someone at that level, a cabinet official comes in and they write out a declaration, an affidavit. That document says, you know, look, I've made the determination that there are secrets, you know, at play here which are vital to national security. If they leak out, the national security will be gravely damaged. And I've also made the determination that if this case goes forward in any way, there's a risk that those secrets are going to get out. And because of that, the government claims once an executive official comes in and says this, the court just has to accept it at face value and not look beyond it at all.
Right. The court doesn't actually get any evidence of this. It's just really flat statements that this will affect the national security and state secrets will come out. I mean, is that essentially it?
That's it. You know, and the interesting thing is that, you know, courts are used to having to deal with sensitive information. You know, they can close a courtroom, they can place briefs under seal, they can put gag orders on the attorneys. In some cases, they can even make the attorneys all seek security clearance before the case goes forward. And usually that's good enough to protect any sort of sensitive information. But what this version of the state secrets privilege that the government is asserting, what it says is really, look, you know, some secrets are so secret that even the judge can't look at them and make up his mind, you know, about what kind of protective measures are necessary. And even the strongest protective measures aren't going to be good enough for some type of secrets. And for those, you know, very special types of secrets, you know, you have to rely on an executive official's judgment. And the executive official's judgment is final. So, you know, really what it boils down to is it's an example of the president and his, you know, cabinet members being able to tell the courts what cases they can and can't hear. And that's really a problem in a situation like this where the allegations in the lawsuit are that the president has violated, you know, a statute put in place by Congress that assigned certain special roles to judges and that, you know, nonetheless, despite the fact that you've got clear violations of law, clear violations of criminal law that Congress has put on the books and that executive officials may have committed felonies, you know, under the state secrets doctrine, that never gets to, you know, sort of come in front of a court.
Now, have the judges ruled in any of these three cases, ACLU, CCR, or the Electronic Frontier case?
No, they haven't. The response briefs haven't even come in our cases. In the EFF case, similarly, it's at a very initial stage. But there have been some prominent cases alleging, you know, the worst kind of executive wrongdoing that have been dismissed.
What were some of those?
Well, there are two cases that really relate to the sort of practice of extraordinary rendition, which is basically the U.S. government getting a hold of individuals and then sending them to third countries so that they can be tortured, interrogated under torture. So we had a case on behalf of Maher Arar, who was stopped while he was trying to connect flights at JFK Airport flying back to Canada. He was a Canadian citizen. The U.S. government interrogated him for about 12 days and then sent him not back to Canada, the country of his citizenship, but instead sent him to Syria with the express purpose of being tortured. That case wasn't dismissed on state secrets grounds, but the government made state secrets privilege the centerpiece of its defense, and the judge ruled on grounds that are somewhat similar to it. Another case that involved a guy who was picked up in former Yugoslavia and sent to Afghanistan on what appears to be a pure case of mistaken identity. Another person who the government was looking for or the CIA was looking for had the same name. He was sent to Afghanistan, tortured for 6 months, and then released. Really appears to be just a straightforward case of mistaken identity.
So we really, at this point, have a state secret that's been put in those cases in one. We have three at least going to go in these electronic surveillance cases, and we're going to have to wait months. Meanwhile, we're all being surveilled, I mean, all the time is what I gather, and that little machine in the AT&T room out there in San Francisco, or big machine, is still operating. So any other hope on the horizon here? Any congressional hope? I mean, it seemed to me like a lot of the members of Congress, and I want to sort of close on this, they just sort of laid down on this one.
Well, I mean, not only laid down. I mean, can you talk about Hayden's role in this? And
That's actually a really good point, Dahlia.
I mean, this is just outrageous what's been happening.
Yeah, I mean, Hayden, who's now the director of the CIA, very secretive organization where you would hope that the person on top is beyond reproach ethically, he was, you know, one of the masterminds of this, really. He was, you know, one of the people who was comfortable with the president's arguments in defense of it and really, you know, went about implementing.
During the whole confirmation process, this NSA spying scandal was out in the public, and that was not enough to stop him dead in his tracks.
It's remarkable.
I thought it would.
It's remarkable.
I thought, oh, certainly. This is going to put a leash on some of the government inappropriate behavior. And I just, you know, I worry that there's not enough hope out there. It's really ironic. I came in from Washington. I come in from Washington to do this show, and I come in on the shuttle. And I saw there was a magazine. The shuttle gives out free magazines. And I picked up this magazine. It's called Upscale. And it has recipes for an artichoke frittata. And, you know, business travelers, here's a good hint for, you know, different hotels in different cities. And a lot of pop culture. And then I just was flipping through, and there's this one article all of a sudden that popped up out of nowhere called All Eyes on You. The government may be watching you and your neighbors. And it talks about the CCR suit, the ACLU suit, and the fact that all of us are under surveillance. It connects it with the FBI COINTEL program and the fact that Bush is not doing anything new, but actually using old tricks and new technology to be invasive at a whole deeper level that really should be scary to many people. And it ends the article with, "It seems the only light at the end of the tunnel is the 2006 elections," and saying, you know, go out and vote and, you know, show your grievance that way. Please tell me there's hope beyond that.
I got to think so. I mean, and then I'll let you close, Shane, because, I mean, you think about Feingold putting in the censure resolution, Senator Feingold, because of NSA wiretapping, and our wonderful senators, including from New York State, ran the other way. They didn't want to be even in the same room with Feingold. So what hope do we got here, Shane? And then we'll let you go.
Right. Well, I think one thing that's hopeful is that the bills that have been proposed in the Senate and elsewhere to sort of change the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to respond to, you know, the fact the president was carrying out this program, they have gotten better and better over the last couple months. So the most recent one proposed by Arlen Specter and Dianne Feinstein actually is a pretty positive bill. It reasserts that Congress has a right to regulate in this area. It extends the emergency period where the president can get a retroactive warrant from 3 days to 7 days, so that it kind of kills that argument that, you know, the court process was too slow to let the president respond quickly to Al-Qaeda. And then it also provides funding for a lot more positions at the DOJ to make FISA applications. So, you know, really responds to one of the things that we've been saying all along, which is that if you have a law enforcement crisis, you add law enforcement agents. You don't just, you know, create legal shortcuts that end up removing, you know, accountability to judges and end up, you know, creating a situation where law enforcement agents doing the wiretapping are basically unsupervised.
When they add a second to the calendar, like every 2,000 years when the leap year falls in a funny way or something. But I think that's about the chances of getting any bill through Congress, Shane.
There won't be anything coming through in the summer, which
that's
is probably
right.
Good.
I agree. It's Michael Smith, Shane. I agree. I think this is not so much a question of not having enough law enforcement officers to do something right. I don't think FISA was right to begin with, but I think this is more of a question of real state policy. And I think you have to look at it, and I'm sure you agree with everything else that's been going on. There's just one aspect of the government from the top down rather than bottom up.
So it goes back to right after 9/11, and we'll end on this. Remember when what was Ari Fleischer said after 9/11 when people were starting to like say, well, why did this happen? He said, watch what you say and watch what you do. So the message out there from this is still you got to watch what you say. Thanks a lot, Shane.
Thanks, Shane.
Bye, Shane.
Take
care. Bye. You got a lot of societies and governments trying to be God, wishing that they were God. They want to create satellites and cameras everywhere, make you think they got the all-seeing eye. I guess the last course wasn't too far off when they said that certain people got a God complex. I believe it's true. I don't get phased out by none of that. None of the helicopters, the TV screens, the newscasters, the satellite dishes. They just wishing. They can't never really do that. When they tell me to fear they law, when they tell me to try to have some fret in my heart behind the things that they do, this is what I think in my mind. And this is what I say to them, and this is what I'm saying to you, check it. All over the world, hearts pound with the rhythm. Fear not of men, because men must die. Mind over matter and soul before flesh. Angels hold the pen, keep a record in time, which is passing and running like a caravan trader. The world is overrun with the wealthy and the wicked, but God is sufficient to dispose of...
In our second part of the Law and Disorder Taser series, we go now to an interview with Amnesty International spokeswoman Mona Kadena. Our co-host, Dalia Hashad, caught up with Mona at the historic Pioneer Square in Portland, Oregon, during this year's Amnesty International's general meeting.
We're here with Mona Kadena from the Western Regional Office of Amnesty International. She is a internationally recognized expert on tasers. She's been involved in the discussion around tasers and really been taking a very hard look at taser use by police departments on our street. Welcome, Mona, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
Yeah. We've noticed that so many people around the country have become increasingly concerned about use of tasers and increasingly frequent use by police officers and then the related deaths and mishaps that happen as a result of taser use. Tell us a little bit about what a taser is and why we should be concerned about its use by police departments.
Well, a taser is an electroshock weapon, and it essentially looks like a small handgun, and it has two darts that fire off the weapon that are attached by 21-foot wires, and those darts attach to either the clothing or the body, and as soon as they attach, it completes the circuit, and it sends 50,000 volts of electricity through a 5-second circuit through the body.
And that's pretty scary, or it sounds scary.
It is quite scary. The circuit automatically shuts off after 5 seconds, but as long as the barbs are attached to either the clothing or the body, you continue to depress the trigger until either the battery runs out or the gun overheats and stops working.
How long does it take for that to happen?
Well, you know, we have seen people being shocked as many as 20 times. In our most recent report, the highest number of shocks, it actually says 20-plus shocks. So we actually, I don't think we know exactly how many times is the max.
So that's a police officer shocking someone for 5 seconds and then pressing it again, 5 seconds and then again, 5 seconds, 20 times, sending all those volts of electricity through a person's body. What does that do to a person?
That is the big question that's out there. And what we don't know is what really happens to the human body.
You've been shot by a taser. What was that like?
I have actually participated not in a full 5-second shock. It's what they call a circle shock, where they put a circle of folks around, we all hold hands, and they send the shock through the circle. And so It's a much faster cycle, and the whole circle just falls.
So what you're saying is it's a circle of people. One person in the circle is shocked, and then that shock travels through each respective body, and anyone you're holding hands with will then be shocked.
That's correct. It's to give you a sense of the intensity and how it feels, but it's a very quick shock. But what happens is the entire circle immediately falls to the ground.
So it is quick, and it is that intense that you can't even continue to stand.
It's actually amazing how much it disrupts your muscle function. I mean, immediately you fall. And it was kind of funny because it's me, and I'm for those of you on the radio, I'm a small girl. I'm 5 feet tall. It was me with a circle of big, giant police officers. And when we all fell, I barely touched the floor because they fell to their knees, and they were holding me up, essentially. But once we got to the floor, we all start falling into a pile. But it's very quick. Your muscles are disrupted just like that. And I can't imagine what it feels like to have 5 seconds shock you.
We're on the streets of Portland. We actually just saw a couple police officers drive by in their car. Tell us, do you know anything locally about the use of tasers here in Portland?
Well, every police officer in Portland does carry a taser, and they've been on the streets since 2004. And just in the last 2 months, there was a death of an individual who was shot multiple times with a taser. And so right now, the Police Use of Force Board is reviewing that incident, and the autopsy report hasn't come out yet, so we're waiting to see what's going to happen.
And how typical is Portland of the rest of police stations around the country? We have every police officer in Portland armed with a taser and able to use it apparently at will.
It's actually not that typical that entire departments are equipped with tasers. Usually departments will buy just a small number, or they'll equip vehicles with tasers, or particular squads will have tasers. There are certainly departments that every single officer does. San Jose, California, every police officer has a taser. What we know is that every department uses their tasers differently. Every department puts it on its force continuum in a different place. Some have it high on the force continuum, some have it very low at the level of something like pepper spray or a baton. So it's very hard to get a real picture of how they're being used, because it's different from department to department, from state to state. There's not a single state in the U.S. that has minimum standards for how tasers should be used.
And you've been here. You came up a couple days early. Tell us what you've been doing the past couple days.
Well, I have been doing a lot of work actually around tasers. I met with the Portland police chief. Actually, she's the acting police chief, Chief Sizer, and we met with her and two of her sergeants who do training for the department here in Portland to talk to them about our concerns with tasers. And, you know, I have to say, you know, as with most of those meetings, it was a mixed bag in the sense that they were receptive and they actually knew about some of the concerns that we already were coming to them with. And they've taken some of our recommendations to heart, but in some cases they're not quite as far as we would like them to see.
Tell us about some of the stories that raise concerns for you about taser use.
I think primarily is that tasers are really billed as an alternative to deadly force. Many police forces, such as Portland and such as San Jose, California, put tasers on the streets as an alternative to deadly force. Portland is actually a really great example. Every single police officer got tasers because there had been a series of police shootings. And the police department said, we want to decrease the number of times our officers use guns. And so we're going to put tasers on the street.
Mona, tell us about some of the stories that you hear about that cause you concern about taser use.
Well, I think across the country we can see that tasers are used as an additional tool on the police belt. They're not used as an alternative to deadly force as they were billed by many police departments, city councils. We're seeing tasers being used on senior citizens. We're seeing them being used on young children. We're seeing them being used when someone fails to comply with a verbal command. And we're also seeing them being used in what's called the drive stun mode, where the taser is put directly against the individual's skin. It's a more superficial shock, but we consider it to be purely for pain compliance.
Wow, so does that release any type of barbs, or the electric shock just travels directly from the weapon into the person's body?
It's just the electric shock directly into the person's body. It's considered to be a more superficial shock because the difference is that the barbs don't pierce the skin. It's just the shock directly onto the body. So it's a more superficial shock, but it's painful in a different way.
One of the stories that I heard about that just really bothered me a lot happened last month. A 92-year-old man with advanced Alzheimer's was swinging his cane, and he was shocked repeatedly. You know, and he kept saying, wow, that really smarts. what it really illustrated to me was, if you will use the taser on a 92-year-old man, you clearly have the sense that this is a harmless weapon. A 92-year-old man is using a cane cannot really harm someone very seriously. You could just, a healthy police officer can just reach out and grab that cane from the person. I think the taser was seen as kind of a shortcut, and that's what concerns me. It's a shortcut to law enforcement that people don't understand how serious the consequences can be. Alona pointed out in my office, she said, you know, when you shock a person who is that old with a taser and they fall to the ground, that really could be a life-threatening injury. When older people fall and break bones, break hips, that could end up being something that kills them. I don't think we're thinking about who tasers are being used on.
I think that's what's quite insidious about the taser, is that when you shoot someone with the taser, there are no physical marks, which is different than when somebody is beaten with their fists or when you use a billy club. There's no blood. You don't see anything except you maybe see a couple of little pricks from where the barbs are. So superficially, it looks like nothing has happened to the human body. But what we don't know is what happens when you send that much electricity through the human body. That's one of our big questions, is the big unanswered medical concern.
We're here in Portland at Pioneer Square, the middle of their weekly anti-war rally, and we're interviewing Mona Cadena of Amnesty International about taser use, police use, and the spreading of tasers throughout the United States. If you could tell a police officer saying, listen, it's not that big a deal. I've been shocked by a taser. It's not that big a deal. We've all seen it. And you know what? It's preferable to me using a gun on someone, wouldn't you say? What's the story that you would tell this person that would change their mind?
Well, I think before I told my story, the first thing that I would say is that what you're offering me is a false choice, because we know that tasers are not used in scenarios where you would use a gun. No officer in his or her right mind is going to pull a taser on someone who's pulled a gun on them. You're offering me a false choice. And one of the stories that always sticks out in my head is there's a story of a boy, and I don't remember what state he's in, but he was at Chuck E. Cheese, and I think he stole a salad, and he got shot with a taser. A police officer shot him with a taser.
At Chuck E. Cheese.
At a Chuck E. Cheese, yes. You know, he's still alive. So fortunately, it's not one of the more than 150 taser-related deaths that we've been looking at since 2001.
We don't know what happens to people when they're shot by tasers, and sometimes people get up and go home after it, or get back in their car and drive away, or I don't know what. And who knows what the long-term effects are, or even short-term effects of someone being shot by a taser.
And every single medical study on tasers, despite what they're lacking in foundational research, ends their study by saying, we just don't know, and we need more information. And they also follow by saying, the more you shock someone, the more it's like playing Russian roulette. Because at some point, that shock could hit someone at the right or the wrong beat of the heart and send someone into ventricular fibrillation.
Why hasn't there been this good medical study that we need? If every study at the end says we need more information, why don't we just get more information? Because a lot of people say, hey, there are proper uses for tasers, and we need them in police departments to have them in their arsenal of tools.
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that question. You know, what we do know is that every study that has been done uses research from the manufacturers of the taser. It's unacceptable that the studies do not go outside, you know, of what the information that the manufacturer gives them.
Have a change of scene, 'cause every night I have the strangest dream. Prison by the way it couldn't be, left here on my own, or so it seems. I've got to leave before I start to scream. Someone's locked the door and took the key. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Oh. Well, boy, you sure took me.
me for one big ride. And even now I sit and wonder why. But when I think of you I start to cry. Just can't waste my time, I must keep dry. Gotta stop believing in all your...
Recently, Michael Smith and I each paid a visit to different correctional facilities. Michael went upstate New York to talk to David Gilbert, and I visited with Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's on death row in Pennsylvania.
Heidi, I know that the National Lawyers Guild, to which all of us belong, has been in regular support of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that you've been regularly visiting him, and you just saw him recently. What was it like?
What an experience. First, I must say it was a true honor to be able to visit him. I've seen him a few other times with his lead attorney, Robert Bryan, from California. He is, I've got to say, one of the most remarkable persons I've ever met. He doesn't talk about his case except in abstract terms. He's very selfless. He's so intelligent, so well-read. And he ties everything into sort of a larger global perspective about how other people, how the injustices of the criminal justice system in this country have put so many people on death row, many of them innocent, most of them with unfair trials and inadequate legal representation. His spirits are excellent. He's just one of the most articulate people I've ever met. I consider it a privilege to know him. And one of the reasons I went was that the Guild is going to be filing an amicus brief in a few weeks, and we hope that other groups, including Amnesty and maybe the Center, will sign on to it, because three issues were certified this past January. These issues are compelling. One is the issue of racism in the jury selection. The issue we'll be writing about is the fact that the prosecutor said to the jurors, your sentence is reviewable. There will be appeal after appeal. And the effect of that, the Supreme Court has held in the past that that is clearly diminishes the juror's sense of responsibility in imposing, deciding whether to impose death, and it's unconstitutional. Jurors look toward prosecutors as having more credibility than defense attorneys, and combined with the other infractions in his case, we think this is definitely grounds for reversal.
Now, what prison did you visit him in?
He's on death row in Waynesburg, Pennsylvania. It's about an hour's drive from Pittsburgh.
So you flew to Pittsburgh?
I flew to Pittsburgh, and I met Robert Bryan at the airport, and we drove out. There's a little hotel that overlooks the prison where a lot of visitors stay before they go to visit in the morning.
How many people on death row?
I asked about that, and I was unable to find out. But they do drug testing. What they do is they do random tests of visitors' cars in the parking lot. We weren't approached this time.
What do you mean,
drug
tests?
Yeah, they open your vehicle. They tell you have
searches.
A right. They do searches. But then they also, once you're in, they swab your hands and they put a little swab in a machine that tests for presence of drugs on your body. But out in the parking lot, they say you have the right to refuse this search. You'll have to leave. The guards told us, and I don't know whether to believe this or not, that a high number of people submit to the search of their vehicle and they find contraband and weapons, and then they call the state police and they come and arrest them.
Now, you visit him in a visiting room. You don't go into the actual cell that he's in.
No,
right?
You can't do that. It's a visiting room, and it's set up with a thick plexiglass divider between us.
There's
no physical contact. They don't allow that. But you're looking at each other through the divider. He's in handcuffs, which is clearly not a security issue. It's clearly to send a message that here is an inmate. Yeah.
During the entire interview, he's in handcuffs?
Yes.
Is there a guard in the room with him?
No, there isn't. There's a recently passed law mandates that to ensure the privacy, even though the rooms are soundproof, just like the studio that we're in, but when you go in, you're given a chain that you attach to the wall outside it that does not allow a guard to be able to look within. There's a door with a window on it guarding where you sit.
And we're speaking with Heidi Boghossian, who recently came back from a visit with Mumia Abu-Jamal,
who's been on death row 25 years. And one point that I'd like to mention is that disregarding the issue of whether or not Mumia actually shot the police officer, whether it was a frame-up. The fact is he got an unfair trial on many levels, incompetent counsel at the preliminary phases of it, a lot of flaws in the case. A judge, Albert Sabo, who was clearly racist and who made a statement, "I hope they fry the N-word," two witnesses in this case. It's really a textbook case of everything that can go wrong. Every constitutional violation did occur in his case, but because of his Black Panther affiliation, his outspokenness against the Philadelphia Police Department when they were corrupt.
When is the appeal going to be heard?
Well, the response from Robert Bryan is due in mid-July. The state's already turned theirs in, so I don't know how soon after that
it'll
be
in the
heard.
Fall,
in the
possibly,
fall, probably.
Or somewhere
yeah,
after that.
Right.
We'll keep covering the story. It was great that you got down there.
It was an honor.
But overall, his spirits were really good.
He's just, I can't keep saying how remarkable he is. His spirits are good. He's selfless. He just wish he could be out so we could have him on the radio show and hear his side, his take on things, because he knows. He was recently made a citizen of France. They love him over there.
They named us,
and they just named Rumumia
after him.
Right.
Yeah. You know, well, I think more than any time since his initial frame-up, that he does have a chance. I think it's looking good for us, and I look forward to the day that we have him up here in the studio
exactly.
with all of us.
Right.
That'll be a wonderful day.
Di, have you been to prison lately?
Yeah. No.
I went up the day after Memorial Day to see David Gilbert up in Dannemora. The place is in American Siberia, just like where Murmia has been stashed, you know.
It's about a 9-hour drive up to
Dannemora.
Oh,
it's unbelievable. Yeah.
It's cold even in the summer in Dannemora.
It took me 2 days to get there from the city. It's like up near the Canadian border. David Gilbert is Chase Aboudin's father. Our listeners will remember Chase has been on our program several times talking about Venezuela. David did a stupid thing, I think he thinks in retrospect, and he got himself 25 years on a felony murder back in 81. His trial was a political trial, and David conducted himself as a political detainee.
What's the underlying offense that he was accused of, Michael?
It was a bank robbery, right. And he was transporting the robbers from the scene. He wasn't at the scene when it happened, but he was transporting the people that actually held up this Brinks truck in the arrest of these people.
It's not just any robbery. I mean, it was a political strategy.
Well, the idea behind it and why David participated in it was they were trying to liberate some funds to fund the movement, and particularly the Black Liberation Army. David was a white guy in a truck, and they figured if the robbers were in the back of the truck seeing this white suburban-looking guy, you know, nobody would stop him. But in fact, they were stopped. In the resulting shootout, there was the death of a security guard and two police officers from Rockland County. Very unfortunate. David's remorse is extensive. But because he said, look, I'm a political prisoner here, there's a struggle going on between this imperialist government and the Black community. These people are prisoners of war, and I'm a political prisoner as well, and I don't recognize the authority of your court. And he turned his back on the court and was awarded 3 consecutive life sentences as a consequence. So he'll be eligible for parole in the year 2056.
And how old is he now, Michael?
He's 2 years younger than I am. He's 61. He was the head of Columbia SDS back in 67. He is just the most remarkable prisoner. When you were talking about Mumia, I was thinking, you know, the same thing of David. Lynn Stewart told me, because she visits him often, and she said, no person in prison I've ever known has done his time better than David. David knows that he may never get out. He keeps himself totally informed, like Mumia. He subscribes and reads the entire New York Times, gets it the day after. He listens to National Public Radio. He subscribes to a bunch of magazines. He didn't want any books from me because there's a limit on how many books he can have in his cell, and he was up to his limit. He's totally on top of things. All he wanted to do was talk about politics here and abroad. I was up there with Jim Cockcroft, who had just been in Cuba and actually met with Fidel. And David wanted to know all about what Fidel had to say about Mexico and Venezuela and Evo Morales' election in Bolivia. He's in a very extensive correspondence with young revolutionaries all across the United States. They see him as a teacher and a mentor. He's been able to develop a whole network of young people who look to him as a leader from the 60s who has something to say to us in our struggles now. And that's really the point to which he's devoted his life. He's made something of his life in prison by being this connection between the generation of the 60s and the current radicalization.
Now, David also has a book, Michael, doesn't he? I don't recall the name.
Yeah, it's called No Surrender.
We'll put up a link on our website on how you can get it. It was published by a Canadian organization that tries to get political prisoners out of prison.
His companion, or his, what has been freed, of course, was Kathy Boudin, who was also accused and convicted in that same robbery, and she has now been out for, I don't know how long, a couple of years, Michael? I don't
know.
Yeah,
it's been a couple of years. She's doing quite well, working, getting a graduate degree. She had the most remarkable prison career of, and this is in Lenny Wineglass's word, of any prisoner in the state of New York. Her accomplishments.
Didn't she write a book?
Poetry. She wrote poetry awards. She developed an AIDS program for prevention for prisoners. She developed programs to help children of women in prison. She was quite extraordinary. And, you know, the same thing would happen if David was let out. He would be a wonderful contribution to society. What do you keep a 62-year-old person in prison for? He's been there 25 years. It's only vindictive and cruel.
Well, we've been talking with Michael Smith, who recently came back from a visit to Dannemora Prison, where he visited political prisoner David Gilbert.
Now, we hear from former Amnesty International Director Bill Schultz. First, an interview with co-host Dalia Hashad, and later, an excerpt from Bill Schultz's speech at the anti-torture rally in Pioneer Square.
I'm particularly pleased to be here in Pioneer Square with Bill, because Bill Schultz has certainly been a pioneer in the domestic human rights movement here in the United States. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Very good to be with you, Dalia.
Thanks. You've been with Amnesty for 12 years, and you're just now retiring from Amnesty, but not from activism. Tell us about some of your plans.
Well, my plans are to try to transform a type A personality into an A minus. I have a year in which I'm going to be doing some teaching of human rights at the New School and working with the Center for American Progress, which is a great new liberal think tank out of Washington, and contemplating perhaps one last job that has remuneration beyond the esoteric.
You have been the pioneer in creating the domestic human rights program here at Amnesty. It did not exist before your tenure here. Tell us about why you thought it was important to bring the human rights framework to domestic issues.
Well, it won't surprise you or too many of your listeners to know that Americans tend to be rather parochial about human rights, about international affairs. The truth is that American politicians often respond far more to American citizens than they do to foreigners. Amnesty International, of course, is an international human rights organization, but in 1999 it undertook a campaign focused on human rights violations here in the United States, and what became obvious as a result of that campaign was that really to effect change in human rights here in the U.S., we need to mobilize Americans, not just the international community. And that was why it seemed to me and to many others within the organization absolutely critical that Amnesty include in its wide panoply of programs a program focused on issues such as criminal justice, the need for reform, the criminal justice system here in the United States, prison conditions, police activities, police brutality, racial profiling, all of these issues which unfortunately characterize the American experience.
How do you think these domestic issues connect with international human rights issues?
The reality is that human rights violations have similarities and patterns across countries, across cultures. We find torture, police misconduct, racial discrimination in virtually every part of the globe. And I'm afraid that Americans have for too long, at least the vast majority of Americans, have for too long assumed that that isn't the case here because of the great ideals upon which this country is based. But I think anyone familiar with American history will be well aware of the faults and fragility of respect for human rights within an American context. And so there is a great deal of common ground between our concerns at the international level and violations here at home. In addition to which, of course, we're living in an era in this country in which respect for human rights and the institutions presuppositions that support them are under tremendous threat. And that's true at both the global and the domestic level. So the two really complement and reinforce one another.
For the past 12 years, you've been at the helm of Amnesty International USA. Where have you seen this USA human rights debate go from 12 years ago to now, 2006?
Well, one of the most positive developments, actually, has been a growing sense among some opinion leaders and decision makers in this country, particularly within a judicial context, that international standards, international norms, do have some applicability to the United States. That was, of course, I think most dramatically brought home in the 2003 and 2005 Supreme Court decisions ruling unconstitutional the execution of the mentally retarded and juvenile offenders, respectively, in which the court cited international practice. We know, of course, that a majority of countries today have either abolished the death penalty in law or in practice. The court cited that, cited international strictures against the execution of the mentally retarded or those who committed their crimes under the age of 18. That's a tremendous change. That is something we probably would not have seen the Supreme Court do 12 years ago. To the extent to which international norms had been taken into account before that. There may have been some technical issues around trade and so on, but rarely was that the case. And I think that in a paradoxical kind of way, the failure of the Iraq War, the tremendous tragedy of that war, has reinforced to Americans the fact that the United States cannot act unilaterally in the world, that it is part of a nexus, a complex of international actors and institutions, to say nothing of 185 other countries in the world, and that the United States is enmeshed in the world. It cannot be a single player. And that, of course, then reinforces the importance of applying global norms to our own practices here at home.
And where do you see activists' role in that pushing that has expanded the vision of the United States to include their part in an international role?
You know, it never takes a majority of people to change a culture. I am always fascinated by the little-known historical fact that on the day that the American troops and their Vietnamese allies lifted off of the roof of the embassy in Saigon, that famous picture of the helicopter lifting off of the roof of the embassy. On that very day that the U.S. finally withdrew from Vietnam, a majority of Americans still favored the Vietnam War, still favored U.S. intervention in Vietnam. And yet, in fact, of course, we know that U.S. policy changed very dramatically. We never need a majority of people. What we need is a well-informed, sophisticated, well-organized, strategically acute minority. And that's what Amnesty International activists and their colleagues in many other organizations are all about. Understanding that, as Eleanor Roosevelt said, human rights begin at home. They begin with small steps, small changes, and the application of these great ideals to our local communities, to our own practices. And Amnesty International activists have always done that, and I trust they always will. And it's been a tremendous honor for me to be a part of that and to be engaged in a mutually supportive and complementary way with the literally tens of thousands of activists in our communities and online now, 400,000 activists online who are engaged in that kind of witness.
Bill, I'm afraid we have to let you go. The crowd is growing, and I think they're waiting for you to start the rally, but I want to thank you so much for being here with us today on Law and Disorder and for supporting the human rights movement and building it up the way you have so consistently in your career. We were really honored to have you here at Amnesty International, and to continue your legacy is really a great privilege and a responsibility that we have. So thank you so much. Tell us, where do you see us moving from here, specifically speaking directly to the activists who are listening?
Well, Dahlia, first of all, thank you for your comments, and I'm absolutely thrilled that you've joined the Amnesty International staff, because truly the effectiveness of our work is embodied in the staff and the volunteers working together in our common agendas. I actually am an optimist about the long-term forecast for human rights. Of course, Spinoza said, always take the view from eternity, and I know that in the long run, as Theodore Parker, a great Unitarian minister, used to say, the arc of the universe bends toward justice. But it requires that a lot of people grab a hold of the arc and keep pulling, keep pulling, keep pulling until it bends just a little bit more towards justice. I think we have the roots here of a very exciting and effective human rights movement. The fact that we have been able in a very short period of time, a year or so, to attract 400,000 new online activists is, I think, indicative of that. We have, that means that between our donor members and our online activists, we have something like 750,000 people involved in one way or the other in human rights work. And I think that bodes well for the future.
Thanks, Bill Schultz. A great message from a great man.
Now, an excerpt from a speech from former Amnesty International director Bill Schultz.
Thank you all. This is my last public appearance on behalf of Amnesty International, and I can't think of a more important issue than this one at which to express my feelings one last time. Nothing has been more devastating to me these 12 years, with the exception of the genocides that we've seen go on around the world. Nothing else has been more devastating than to know that my country, our country, has joined the list of the torturers. When Amnesty International was founded 45 years ago, no one could have imagined that we would have to be here today in Pioneer Square asking the United States to stop torture. Soviet Russia, yes, of course. Pinochet's Chile, certainly. North Korea, absolutely. But the United States was to be the gold standard, the model of rectitude. Well, Amnesty International calls the devil by the devil's name, no matter who the devil is, and that's what we're doing here today. And I want us to extend a special appreciation to Eric Bailey and Group 48, who put this rally together and who exemplify the best of what Amnesty is all about. Because Eric and Group 48, all of us, the American people, know that torturing people or sending them overseas, that's not the America we want to live in. That is not the America of spacious skies and spacious hearts. That is not the America of a sweet land of liberty of which we sing. It's not the land of the free. It's not the home of the brave. And we are here to say enough. We are here today to take back our country. We want to be proud of America again. We want a country that is a paragon, not a pariah. We want a country that is outstanding, not outcast. Not a country that finds an assassin in every Arab, a murderer in every Muslim, a time bomb under every turban. Not that kind of country. We want to be proud of America. We want a country that is righteous, not reprehensible, a law leader, not a lawbreaker, a model of courage, not a purveyor of carnage. We're here today to take back America from the cowboys and the crusaders, from the cynics and the sycophants, to take back America for every good and decent person on this planet. And the way to do that today is to force every member of Congress to answer a simple question. Are you for renditions or are you against them? If you haven't signed the petitions that are circulating to Congress, do it before you leave today. This question is simple. Is this land of America the land of the brave or the land of the brute? Is this the land of the free or the land of the phony? Is this the sweet land of liberty of which we sing? We are here to say, stop torture, stop renditions, and give us back our country.
Bill Schultz, everyone. Stop torture now. Stop torture now.
If you would like to hear Law and Disorder on your local or campus radio station, please contact us through our website, lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.